KU, we are news in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you saw the blockbuster movie Noah earlier this year, you would have seen just the latest version of a story that's been around for a very long time. The British scholar and historian Irving Finkel says the story of a flood that destroys the world with a hero who builds a massive boat is almost universal in cultures throughout the world. You'll find a version of it in India, Central America, Australia, Greece, not to mention the Middle East. Finkel has decoded a story about a flood and an ark on an ancient tablet. It's a story written down more than 1,000 years before the story in the Old Testament. Irving Finkel will join us today to help us understand these flood stories and why we've told them for thousands of years. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For about 5 years or so, the British Assyriologist Irving Finkel has been decoding, translating an ancient tablet about the size of a cell phone. It was written by a Babylonian some 4,000 years ago in a language long since extinct, cuneiform. The tablet contains a flood story, one that may be familiar to you if you know the story of the flood in Genesis in the Bible. The story Finkel translated is of a god telling a heroic man that he is going to destroy the earth with a flood and that this man is to build a boat big enough for animals who will march two by two into the vessel as the rains begin. The name of the god and the heroic man are different, and the shape of the boat is different too. That's a big deal, but the basics are very much the same. The thing is, this story was told more than 1,000 years before the story in the Bible. Finkel says it was a story the Hebrews may have borrowed from the Babylonians. Irving Finkel has written a book about this tablet he's been working on called the Ark Tablet. It is also about these stories about floods that have played out through human history. The book is called The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood. Irving Finkel studies archaeology, history, and languages, the languages of ancient Mesopotamia and other cultures that use cuneiform writing. He's the assistant keeper of ancient Mesopotamian script, languages, and cultures at the British Museum in London. And he's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. And Irving Finkel, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, I'm very glad to be here.
I want to begin by backing up just a bit and talk a little bit about George Smith, because this is how you begin your book. In 1872, he discovers a cuneiform tablet that, as you say in the book, astounded the world. This is the story of the flood. Talk about George Smith's discovery.
Well, George Smith was a remarkable person because he wasn't trained at university or anything. He was just very interested from boyhood on, and he was taken on in the museum to work in the collections. And he taught himself to read this cuneiform script almost unaided. And he was put on sorting out bits of tablets which had come from Iraq over the previous decades into the museum, which had a kind of literary content. He had a very good eye for this. And one day he found a large piece, which was obviously literature. And when he started to read it, he suddenly realised the thing in his hands was a recounting of the flood, which from the point of view of the book of Genesis was very familiar. And of course, at that time, he knew his Genesis story very intimately indeed. So it was a very traumatic and astonishing moment for him when, as he deciphered these cuneiform signs line by line, he found himself reading what was to all intents and purposes the same story.
Smith was described as a sensitive man, highly nervous man. And when he cracks the story, he not only jumps up and down, he takes his clothes off. He was so excited.
Yes, well, there's a record of this in our department, because he dropped the tablet on the table, which you're not supposed to do. That's a heinous crime anyway. Yes. And then he started running around the room, holding his head and making funny noises. And then only after that, he started to tear off his clothes in anxiety. And I can understand, in a way, why that would be, because it was completely unsuspected that such a crucial part of Holy Writ, which was heard in churches and synagogues and all over Britain in those days. Everybody knew that story, to find it in such a context for the first time. Mm. It must have been overpowering for him.
How did the world, do we know, how did they react to this news? As you mentioned, it was traumatic for not just Smith, but a lot of religious people.
I think it was. He did something rather ingenious. He gave a very public lecture about it in London, and they took pains to invite everybody who was powerful and influential, where he made the announcement. And there was a sort of furore, and everybody talked about it till 2 in the morning. But one of the interesting things was that the Daily Telegraph, which was it's still in existence, it was a 19th century English newspaper, stumped up some money to send Smith back to Iraq, where he'd been before, to see if he could find a bit more of the story, which he did. So that was one interesting consequence. But on a more serious level, it was theologically rather difficult for clergymen and religious people who knew their Bible and who took its nature and its unique nature for granted and its divine origin for granted, to find this sort of rival version. And there were lots of anxious inquiries. No one was quite sure at that time which story was older, because the big piece that Smith discovered for the first time actually was written in the 7th century BC, so it was quite late in Mesopotamian terms, and that wasn't such a long time before people thought maybe some of the Bible stories existed. So at that time, there was a lot of anxiety about, as it were, did the Babylonians pinch it from the Hebrews? Did the Hebrews pinch it from the Babylonians?
Right. Well, your part in this story begins in 1985. A man named Douglas Simmons comes into the British Museum.
And this is quite a dramatic thing that happened to me. But of course, in some ways, it's not so surprising, because one of the things that curators do is to look at objects which people have in their families and they've never known what they are. They bring them in and we're supposed to know what they are and give them a special opinion. So this was one of these examples, when this chap came in with a small collection of stuff which he got from his dad when he was a boy. And among them were 2 or 3 pieces of clay covered in cuneiform writing. And one of them was, as you aptly describe, rather like a cell phone in size and dimension. And that was the first one I picked up to read. And instead of being a very mundane sort of document, like a letter or something, which is what it looked like, it turned out to be a piece of real literature in the George Smith sense of the word, because this was part of the same story of the flood, only this one was written about 1,000 years earlier, something like 1750 BC.
Now, he wouldn't let you take it at the
time.
Well,
no. I know. Well, he was quite a strange person. He was rather secretive. He didn't talk very much. I said, well, you know, this is a piece of the flood story. You have to realise that. And he kind of nodded and made a small noise. And then when I'd explain what the other things were, he carefully put them back into the container, which he brought with him, and off he went. And I wasn't empowered to seize him and tie him to the chair and ransack this parcel. It was his property, and all my job was to give an opinion, and that's all he wanted. So, in fact, I didn't see this rather special document for quite a long time until things worked out rather fortunately, because I met him again in the museum. He was in one of the galleries and we had a conversation, and he promised to bring this thing in and let me read it properly. And that's when the real story began.
Mm. This was 2009. It's interesting.
Yes.
He had the tablet since that time that you first saw it in 85. He had had it fired in a kiln and then put in a box. That seemed crazy to me that they would fire these.
A crazy
these
thing.
Things. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, I mean, now my hair stands on end when I think of it, because he found somebody who knew about pottery and kilns and stuff, and he said, oh, we want to fire this clay to make it stable, because clay is a fairly stable material when it's not fired, but of course if it gets wet, that's a disaster. And obviously he thought this was a good idea. I guess the guy must have done it before. And then he had a nice box made to keep it in, and he kept it on his shelf. And it was enough for him to know what it was and not to go any further with it. So I got on with lots of other things, because the museum is full of all sorts of other interesting inscriptions, of course. And then that time later, he handed it over to me, and he said that I could keep it in my room as long as I needed to read it properly. So something must have happened to him. Maybe he got more curious. I don't know what. As I say, he wasn't a very talkative person. So I was very glad to get my hands on this tablet once and for all. And then I started to read it. And that's when all these extraordinary things happened to me, which ended up my writing this book and ended up talking to you today.
Absolutely. You got right to work, you say, armed with a lamp, a lens, and a freshly sharpened pencil. What was that
exactly
like, the process? Because you describe it in the book. It fits and starts and groans and expletives and, of course, lots of excitement. So it must be frustrating at times, but incredible. There must be a lot of adrenaline going through at the right times.
There's a lot of adrenaline. But you see, the thing is this. The first four or five lines of this tablet, A, they were well-preserved, and B, they were very famous, because there are, since Smith's time, maybe a dozen or so bits and pieces to do with this flood story. And this moment when the Babylonian god called Enki decides to warn the human race in the form of this Babylonian Noah that this is what's going to happen, I think it's true that virtually all of the ones that survive have part of this famous speech. It's like a kind of cliche. So that when you read the first line, which is wall, wall, read wall, read wall, which is the moment when this god is whispering the message so that it goes through to this this Noah character, it's a kind of cliche. So that when you've done a bit of Assyriology, as we call it at university, if you've learnt some cuneiform and you read, that's one of the things that you would definitely read. So it was immediately recognisable to me, and I thought, my goodness me, this is it.
Yeah.
But as you go down the tablet, it becomes less well preserved. And the other thing is, there is no parallel, because when you have ancient literature, which is what we're talking about, and you have manuscripts from different places and different times, sometimes, despite 500 years of difference or maybe many hundreds of miles of distance in between, you find that people have the same story in the same words. And with the famous things, like the Gilgamesh epic, for example, the different manuscripts are virtually identical. But with this one, which was a lot earlier, about, as I said, 1750, there was material on this tablet which had not been found on any other tablet. So that meant I was on my own with it, that there was nothing I could use as a kind of crib, because when a text is broken, if you have a parallel, you read the parallel and you think, oh, well, this sign ought to be such and such and this sign ought to, and then you can kind of wiggle it until you get it out. But here, it was just this manuscript alone that gave the information.
We'll come back to this idea of what the Ark tablet was, because you get at that in the book a lot. But I wanted to ask you something that you say in the book, that by the age of nine, you wanted to work in the British Museum, and it was something...
Well, I'm afraid that's true. It sounds a bit weird to normal people, but I came from this kind of family. There were lots of children, and the way I look at it is this. The abnormality about us was this, that we used to go to the British Museum when it wasn't even raining, because most families, you know, they think, what are we going to do? I know, it's free, we can go there and we can have a cup of tea. You know, it's a great idea for a day out for the children. Nonsense, no children really think that. But in our family, it was a different thing. And I don't know why. I tuned into it from an early age. And by the time I was nine, I was quite certain that that's what I wanted to do. Although I didn't know what, as it were, what department it would be or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, you were very interested, you say in the book, in ancient Egyptian. But then a professor suggests, while you're waiting for a particular teacher to teach Egyptian, he says, why don't you do a little cuneiform in the meantime? And I guess that struck.
That's what happened to me. I mean, really, it was a purely fortuitous thing. And I went and knocked on this professor's door in a tremulous sort of way. And this was the time in the 1960s when proper professors who wrote books and were famous, the last thing they wanted was students, because they took a lot of time. You know, you had to look after them and you had to teach them things. And most professors would rather have no students at all. In fact, there were many professors who didn't have any students from one decade to another. But that doesn't happen anymore. But this was that sort of period. So he was very sniffy and very discouraging, but I kind of stuck to it. And when we started, like, he gave me these signs. He said, learn these signs, let's see how you get on with that. So I learned all these signs very hard all over the weekend and went in the next Monday morning, and then we started reading a text. And that was it for me. The whole of my life clicked into a sort of narrow gauge railway line which stretched into the remote future with the British Museum halfway along it.
Explain what cuneiform is. It's the world's, at least as we understand it, I suppose, the world's oldest, most difficult.
As far
writing?
As we know, yeah. Yes. It's a bit difficult to say oldest in archaeology because sure. You never know right. What might come out of the ground. But on present understanding, cuneiform writing is older, say, than Egyptian hieroglyphs, and it's the oldest kind of writing that we can really point to that was proper writing. And it was first, the first steps towards it were developed in Iraq, ancient Iraq, right. In about probably 3,500 BC, a very long time ago. And there was a long process of elementary drawings and symbolic drawings until it got to the stage of what we call cuneiform. And this is not a commonly known word in the real world, but the word cuneus in Latin means a wedge. And the reason that the 19th century scholars called it cuneiform or wedge-shaped is that when the people who wrote this script on clay made their signs, they did it with a sort of chopstick affair. And each of the signs had many different strokes. And each application of this chopstick to the surface of the clay, when it left a line behind, often had a little head on it just by accident, because that's what happens when you press a chopstick into clay. I don't know if you've ever tried that, but it always happens. So that's why they called it that. And what happened was, after a lot of false starts and complex mucking about, eventually it refined itself into the most beautifully clear, lucid, but complicated writing system, which the Sumerians used to write their language, mm-hmm. and then the Babylonians used. And after that, people all over the Middle East tended to use it as well, until the alphabet came along.
What do we know about the scribes who wrote it? Because you say that we know they were men. We know they probably went to school or must have gone to school, but we don't know much else about that, I guess.
Well, we know a bit about their school because the training was long and arduous, and it employed a system which, up until fairly recently, was current in Great Britain, which is this, that the teacher is armed with a knobbly oak stick, something like that, and material is handed over to the pupils to learn, and if they don't learn it, they get beaten. Now, the Sumerians relied on this system on a daily basis, and it was very effective because they had to learn hundreds and hundreds of signs, and if their teachers had been kind and sweet and said, oh, you're doing so well, perhaps you can learn another one, they would never have learned anything. So they believed in brutality as a system. And I have to say that when you're learning cuneiform, brutality is essential. My own professor preferred intellectual cruelty rather than physical cruelty.
Irving Finkel is with us. He is a scholar of archaeology, history, and languages of ancient Mesopotamia, author of the book, The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood. And we'll get to the story of the flood when we get back from a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Noah and the Ark. Actually, we're talking about flood stories like the one in the Bible, Noah and the Ark. The British archaeologist and historian, language expert Irving Finkel is our guest. He says a lot of cultures had flood stories where gods or God destroyed the earth with water. He says the authors of the Old Testament actually borrowed their flood story from the Babylonians. He spent years translating a Babylonian tablet which tells of a flood and an ark filled with animals. crucially, and we'll talk about this, this boat was round. The book is called The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood, and Irving Finkel is joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. So you mentioned the story of a flood that destroys the world. It's an almost universal story. When do we first start knowing about these kinds of stories, flood stories?
Right. Well, again, the oldest evidence comes from Mesopotamia itself. What happens is that among all the different tablets of different subjects that we have in our museums, and they are very numerous now, there's a tabletop perhaps full of bits of clay with part of this story on. And we mentioned before that the cuneiform could be used to write Sumerian or Babylonian, and we have flood stories in both languages. There's one or two bits in Sumerian, and then there are several pieces in the Babylonian language, both written in the same strange script. So we can see, actually, when you look at all this, that the two important things. One is that the Babylonian flood itself was very important in ancient Mesopotamia, because we have, as I say, a Sumerian story. And then we have a story in Babylonian where the hero is called Atrahasis. This is the same kind of period as the tablet we were talking about before, about 1800 BC, something like that. So we have this story where the Noah character is called Atrahasis. Mm. And then we have a completely different account of it in the middle of the Gilgamesh epic, which is the most famous Mesopotamian thing. And you find Gilgamesh mentioned in books of poetry or books about literature on a much broader stage than just ancient Mesopotamia. And in the 12 chapters of that narrative, in chapter 11, the hero, Gilgamesh, is talked to by Utnapishtim, who is the last version of the Babylonian Noah, who tells him all that happened and how he built the boat. So we have different versions of it, and that shows that it was an important part of their sort of cultural materials. That's the first point. And the second point, which is equally significant, is that I feel certain that this story began in Mesopotamia because it is so much embedded in their literature and it makes so much sense within their own landscape. Yeah. Because what we call ancient Mesopotamia, which is more or less modern Iraq today, is named after the two great rivers which feed it with life-giving water, the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. And it's the space between those rivers, Mesopotamia in Greek, which is the heartland of the Sumerians and the Babylonians and the all the nations that came after them in the ancient Iraqi world. Mm. Now, we know from lots of evidence that these benevolent rivers could also be malevolent, that flooding was a regular feature of life, sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes very dangerous. And the sort of the waterine backdrop to the whole narrative makes a lot of sense if it's located in that geographical area.
It's interesting. The language in the Ark tablet that you've decoded, wall, as you mentioned that. Yes. This is how this god is trying to communicate with humankind. He makes different attempts to communicate to Atrahasis. First, tries a dream, and then we get this reference to wall. He tries talking through or to this reed wall. Is that how it goes?
Well, do you know what? This is actually a rather revealing thing, because Enki was one of the top three gods. And Enki was bound over by an unspoken oath that all the decisions made in the divine parliament were secret. Mm-hmm. No major god was allowed to divulge decisions to the human race. And this Enki felt that if all the human population was obliterated, no one would do any work, there'd be no sacrifices for the gods, and everything would be very bleak. So he took it upon himself to pass on this information, but he did it in a clever way, because he didn't speak into the ear of Atrahasis himself. What he did is he hung around where he lived, because this Atrahasis, who was conceived to live in a time obviously before the flood, had a great house made of reeds with a reed fence round it. And as I imagine it, this god whispered his voice flowing with the wind among these rustling leaves, and the message went through somehow, and Atrahasis picked it up in that way. And the reason for it was this, that he didn't want anybody to say afterwards, well, you ratted on us, you gave this away, you interfere with it, you know, you're going to be in big trouble. Because he can say, well, I was out for a walk, I was humming to myself, I was just meditating, and it's not my fault if somehow or other this chap heard me. So I think it's a device to exculpate him from what might have been a serious charge of treason.
Then when you think about this reed wall, it makes a lot of sense when you think about, as you said before, the sort of the landscape of Mesopotamian culture, the wetland marshes of southern Iraq, which you point out stayed pretty much the same for thousands of years up until Saddam Hussein, pretty much.
That's absolutely true. And this landscape is very beautiful and very stark. And there are lots of wonderful photographs taken from earlier in the 20th century where you can see how it operated. And you have a kind of marsh area with floating islands of reeds with a hut in the middle and a fence round it and all the animals sort of grazing round and round and long, narrow boats that flit through the waters. It's a very beautiful landscape and certainly is more or less unchanged since the time of the Sumerians and the Babylonians. But more importantly, I think it's how the Babylonians themselves visualized their own remote past. Because at the time this tablet was written, you had rather sophisticated society. There were kings who had bards and poets and artists in their court, and there was literature and music, and there was politics and all the normal stuff of life. And people were affluent or otherwise, but they were blasé, they were sophisticated, they weren't sort of naive. But the significant thing is that this watery landscape, which survived far down south, I think was how they themselves visualized the world before the flood came.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Ryan is with us in Provo, Utah. Ryan, welcome.
Hey, Doug.
Hi.
So my question is, your guest mentioned that the new script was a rival to the Old Testament. And in my mind, I'm thinking, if this really happened, or if I'm a person that believes in the flood and in Noah, wouldn't I find another account, not as a rival, but as something that supports it? It might be from a different point of view. It might have details that aren't in the Old Testament, or, you know, things that, you know, come in or come out depending on the perspective. But wouldn't that, you know, authenticate what's in the Old Testament rather than make it look like it's a fake or a copy?
Well, this is the question, Irving Finkel, you must get all the time. The fact that, yes, there's this universal flood story. It has to tell us that there it was. That story in the Old Testament is true. There was this massive universal flood. How do you respond to that?
Well, look, the first thing is that when you read the story in Genesis and you read the best preserved Babylonian story, you can see how that they are definitely closely related from a literary point of view.
Right.
Now, there are different ways of looking at this, but this is the way I see it, that the old Babylonian story, which is chronologically probably older, had as its central conception the following, that man, Babylonian man, so to speak, was going to be destroyed by the gods because they were noisy. Now, this is an interesting theological matter, that the gods meet in heaven and they're fed up with the hubbub from below. They're irritated by the fracas, the noise of the human race. So they think they will just wipe them out and invent something alternative, which was hardworking and quiet. So the pivot in Babylonian philosophical thinking that justifies, so to speak, the destruction of man was basically noise.
Right.
Now, when you encounter the very similar story in the Hebrew book of Genesis, you have a narrative, you have a sequence of events, of a powerful, dramatic story, which is very similar to the one in Babylonian. But what is crucially significant is that the underpinning of that, the philosophical underpinning of that, is that man was sinful,
right,
and that it was sin that was the reason for the destruction. Now, when you compare those two perspectives, it seems to me that you can set up this kind of model in your mind, which doesn't tamper with the Bible or anything built on it, because what you have is a kind of dress of ideas. You have this very dramatic story, which the Babylonians first had, which is the sort of story that everybody finds dramatic. Everything is going to be destroyed. One hero has got very little time to do something about it and safeguard life for the future. This is an extremely potent, dramatic, Hollywood kind of narrative. And I think that the Judean poets and philosophers who had a hand in the fashioning of the book of Genesis thought this story was very powerful, because it showed that man is totally vulnerable to the Almighty, and that the Almighty can send one or other natural force and there's no resistance to it. And they adopted the narrative, the kind of the fluent structure of the wording, but for a whole different idea, which was that they were all sinful and only one upright man walked the earth, and he was the person charged with this job. So they kind of, as I see it, recycled it. When I said before pinched one to the other, it was a kind of facetious thing, but in real terms, thinking about it seriously, I see it as a kind of literary recycling.
And you say the Hebrew people must have encountered the story during the time of the Babylonian exile, the time when Jews from the kingdom of Judah were held captive in Babylon. That's one sense of it all, is that that's how they began to hear this story, is during that time?
I think that must be the case, because to my mind, you know, my own work is involved in reading ancient texts and thinking about them as texts and their structure and their format and their literary qualities and so forth, that when you look at the two narratives, Hebrew and Babylonian, they are, in my view, so close that you have to assume that one is modelled on the other from a literary point of view. And if you make this idea, you have to explain it. So we do know, not only from the narrative of the Bible, but also from Babylonian sources as well, about the destruction of Jerusalem and how all the Judeans, the king and the court and all the poets and all the thinkers were taken away after the temple was destroyed to begin their exile in Babylon. So we've known for a very long time, everybody knows that these Judeans found themselves, from living in a rather small provincial kind of kingdom, suddenly thrust into the middle of the most bewildering capital in the world, a bit like Manhattan. Must have been very strange for them. And it seems to me this is the place, the locus, and the opportunity for these people to have picked up on these narratives which were at home in Babylon and had been for a long time.
There's a part in the book I wanted to ask you about. It's when you imagine a kind of a friendly conversation between a Babylonian of the time and a Judean immigrant at a market somewhere in Babylonia. And if the Babylonian, you say, were to ask questions like, what is your God called? What does he look like? You know, who's his wife? How many children does he have? You see that the person, the Judean, would have no sense about that. I mean, they had their innovation, I suppose, was that there was one God that who was harder to sort of conceive of, that a Babylonian had a different concept of God. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think this is a crucial matter, because the Babylonians conceived of their gods like human beings in essence, and all of them were accessible, and they had these characteristics of partners and children and houses and all this kind of thing. And of course, they often had lots of names, not only one. And the extraordinary thing about the Judean situation, as I see it, is that they were ripped out of their original existence. Their temple was burnt to the ground. The cult was over. They had no homestead. They were refugees in a totally alien world. And the only thing which they had as a kind of shield to bind themselves together in the face of this new existence was a God who was purely abstract. Because this matter that no one knew what God was called is extraordinary. And the fact that he had no wife and no children and there were no statues and there was no, I mean, what was there, in fact? Nothing marketable, nothing that they could put on a table for to reflect their own existence. It was purely an abstraction. And it seems to me that a refugee population displaced in this way with only the most abstract concept to bind them together was in peril. and it would have vanished from the face of the earth, exactly as the Israelites did 100 years later when the Assyrians invaded the north. They took all the Israelites off and they relocated them around the Assyrian Empire, and they're lost to history. So we have to ask ourselves, why didn't the same thing happen to the Babylonians? And the matter is compounded by the fact that, as it were, from human stock point of view, the Judeans and the Babylonians were cousins. They spoke cognate Semitic languages. In fact, many of the educated Judeans spoke Aramaic, just as the Babylonians did too. So it would seem to me that unless some other factor had come into play, these displaced peoples would have vanished into Babylonian society. They'd have married their daughters off, they'd have done this, they'd have done that, and a few generations on, they would have vanished from sight. Whereas, in fact, what actually happened was that this abstract religion, this very elusive abstract religion, and the society that went with it and the tradition that went with it became rigidly reinforced by this experience. It was concentrated and it was defined by this experience. And that's why it's, as it were, still going strong. I mean, it's a very interesting speculation that when Jehoiakim and his court first saw Nebuchadnezzar's ziggurat and they walked down the processional way, trembling with fear, and looked all around them at the might that was Babylon, like the might that was Rome. Well, all those gods of Babylon, the Marduk and all the other famous gods and all the gods of the Egyptians and all those gods, they're all dead. They're all finished. But this religion, which had its, in my view, crucial rebirth in this environment, is still alive in the world. I think that's a rather interesting matter. And the explanation, in my view, is that it was this situation that prompted the recording of their history from the beginning of time all the way through the patriarchal period and down into the historical period, with all the information about ritual and hymns and poetry and love songs and censuses and all the stuff they had available, woven into one single manuscript which defined their existence. Mm.
So in that sense, it doesn't really matter, and you don't adjudicate the question of whether there was any kind of universal flood in the book. I mean, the point is that they had the story to cling to.
They had the story, exactly. And I think a story is a much better word for this material than a myth, because myth has within it, especially in modern usage, a kind of critical implication that maybe the thing isn't true. And I think in the Babylonian world, the flood story, in which the hero rescues life by means of a boat, is on a deep level an answer to a pregnant and unending fear that some arcane ancient flood, which really destroyed their culture in the remote past, could easily happen again. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of different material that bears on this, for example, geology and the study of cores and the analysis of plate movements and all these sorts of things to do with that. But that I myself am not so concerned with it. It seems to me that the consequence of the Mesopotamian tradition is that there must have been a kind of tsunami. There must have been, at some point in the remote past, which nobody ever forgot. And it would have been long before writing, something which is passed down as a kind of fear, a story. Maybe it was sometimes really frightening, sometimes it was softened by some other version. I don't know, but I think that was a deposit in their psyche, and that the story of the flood, where the heroic Noah type with his heroic boat make sure that the seed of life withstands this destruction and everything can start over again, is a kind of security answer to that deep-seated fear.
Irving Finkel is with us. His book is The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood. We're going to get to the question of the shape of the ark when we get back from a break. Ryan, thanks very much. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Okay. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Irving Finkel. We're talking about his book, The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. Well, let's talk about, I think, the most sort of fascinating part of the story in some ways. You mentioned the most remarkable feature in this Ark tablet that you've been working on is that the boat mm-hmm. was round.
Yes. This was a big shock to me because who would have thought of it? I mean, if you read your Bible, you know roughly what the ark's supposed to have looked like from the Genesis point of view. And I think in most people's minds, a much more prominent image is a toy ark, which is sort of like a half a watermelon, it seems to me, with a little house in the middle and a ladder. I mean, those are the reference images that one has for the ark. And I have to say, it was an astonishing thing to read on this tablet. Unfortunately, the words are unambiguously perfectly preserved, that the ark had to be round. And Atrahasis, the hero, had to draw it on the ground and mark it out. And it tells us not only that it was round, but the size of it and all the materials. So the thing is, if you imagine yourself reading this tablet and discovering that this long-nurtured idea was suddenly going to be revolutionised and that it was a round ark, how can this be, especially if you're not familiar with round vessels in general, which a lot of people aren't. But, of course, riverine communities all over the world, and Mesopotamia was no exception, used round boats on the rivers all the time because they built coracles out of the natural materials, which were reeds and rope made of pith, and they use bitumen to waterproof it and wood to get stiffen it up. All these materials were there for the asking, and this is what people since time immemorial had been doing. So they would build a round thing. It's a bit like a waterproof basket, which has the advantage that it may go round and round, but it will never sink, which they used at the time of King Hammurabi or King Nebuchadnezzar in ancient Mesopotamian times, rather like a modern taxi service. There were probably lots of them on the river because there were no bridges. And these guys would shepherd a few people or a few animals from one side of the river to another as their regular work. So it seemed to me this, that if you imagine a poet writing or recounting this story and for one reason or another thinking to himself, you know, if there were such an ark, if we had such an ark, what would it look like? The coracle, the round coracle, would be a very suitable vessel, especially as this. And it's only recently that it occurred to me that when you have a normal toy ark, it looks like it has a front and a back, a prow and a stern, and it's going to go from A to B on a voyage. But of course, the truth about the Noah situation and the Atrahasis situation is all that the thing had to do was to float safely with a roof on it, keeping everything safe inside. They didn't have to go anywhere at all. So in fact, a coracle with a roof was a jolly good idea.
I love the section where you write about the animals, this command to collect all the animals on earth, and put that in perspective, because you say in the Hebrew flood tradition, for example, like the Babylonian flood tradition, that the idea of all animals probably, you have a sense in it, would have meant a range of species that they knew of. They probably wouldn't have conceived
yes,
of
exactly.
giraffes and those
That's
kinds
it.
Of things.
And this is a really important matter, you know, because when people talk about Noah's Ark, I've heard such conversations before when people say, well, you can't possibly have had a boat that would take all the animals because, A, there wouldn't be enough room, they couldn't breathe, and the heavy ones would squash the little ones. And, you know, and everybody knows, because of all sorts of wonderful television documentaries these days, just how many animals there are in the world and how many extremes. And this is a kind of stumbling block to the acceptance of the ark story in a practical sense. In other words, if you concede that it might have happened, was it possible? Mm-hmm. And the truth about the animal situation, as you rightly say, is that both the Babylonians and the Hebrews, when they said all the animals, they only meant the ones they knew. And this is a very different matter, because the animals of Iraq or of the Middle East are very circumscribed in comparison with the London Zoo or David Attenborough's wonderful documentaries about all the animals of the universe. Kind of idea.
Well, it's great. This is one of my favorite parts in the book. And you'd say, just for fun, let's list them. And you actually have a list of the animals that could have appeared in some kind of ark, or in any way the animals that would have been familiar to the people of that time.
Well, I had this idea, you know, when I really got to work on it, I tried to imagine this Noah thing for myself, not like in the movie, but trying to imagine one of these practical things. And I thought, what would he do? He'd stand at the head of the gangplank with a register, like a school teacher, wouldn't he? And he would tick off Mr. Hippo, Mrs. Hippo, Mr. Ant, Mrs. Ant. And I thought to myself, how am I ever going to work out what they would be? And then I remembered that among all the... We have these marvellous dictionaries from Babylonia. They're called lexical texts, which sounds like they're the most boring thing in the world. But actually what they really are is marvellous lists of words. And about the time the Ark Tablet was written, very close in fact, in the 18th century BC, there was a big effort in schools to write down on one big tablet all the names of all the wild animals. So we actually have this register. And I couldn't resist the idea of translating it into English so that one could see what was involved. And of course you have to do the same for the ones in the Bible. Isn't it much more difficult to do it with Hebrew than it is with Babylonian, because the Hebrew words only occur once, some of them. So we've got no idea. And if you look historically, people say it's a ptarmigan or it's a, I don't know, an anteater, the same word, because nobody really knows. So the Hebrew, which ought to be much easier than the Babylonian, is actually much harder.
Here's a question from Robert, who wonders, do flood stories exist in cultures where floods were regular and expected and beneficial? And he's referring, I guess, if you live on the Euphrates or the Tigris, and there are, you know, it floods on a regular basis, you'd keep that story in your culture, I suppose.
I think so. I think we can take for granted the riverine nature of their existence, but I think it has to be compounded by a tsunami kind of event that was so out of the ordinary and so destructive that is what dropped this into the psyche. Because if it was just normal flooding, even if it was serious flooding, it wouldn't have this effect. But it kind of scarred them, I think. And I've had this other idea, you know, if you consider that the story of the boat and the rescue was a kind of security answer to the fear of flooding, then in a rather interesting way, the whole of the flood story in Babylonia is a bit like the rainbow in Genesis, because it's specific, it's explicit in the book of Genesis that after the flood's over and everything starts again, the rainbow is the explicit symbol that this will never happen again. And I think the Babylonians were after that explicit symbol. They wanted it. And the flood story was a kind of groping towards some kind of divine let out so that they would know that whatever happened in the future, whatever disasters happened, that somehow life would continue.
So the rainbow was a Hebrew innovation. That doesn't appear in the cuneiform stories.
Not yet. Huh. But on the other hand, you have to be careful, because until this new tablet came, we didn't know about the animals going in two by two in Babylonian at all, only in Hebrew. And then we found that. So you never know about rainbows.
Yeah. You mentioned a lot of the distinctions, or comparing the flood story from ancient Mesopotamia and the one in the Bible. A lot of differences and distinctions in the story. But you say that one of the most compelling pieces of evidence that the Hebrews may have borrowed this story from Gilgamesh or any of the other stories is what you call the test flights of the birds after the flood. Tell that story.
Well, I think that's very interesting, because both of them share in common this issue that once the immediacy of the storm abated, the boat would ride on the waters, which would gradually subside. And in both in the Babylonian version and in the Hebrew of Genesis, Noah, we'll call him both Noah for the sake of argument, releases, I forget the order of them now to my shame, but three birds. And the first comes back and the second comes back because there's no branches above the water, but the third doesn't, which means that they knew that eventually, you know, they were on their way down and that there was already something above the water surface. And that's in both of them. And some scholars who are desperate to sunder the two things say, well, look, the birds aren't the same birds. And okay, this is a legitimate matter, but it from the point of view of a literary motif, it is so striking and so central that to me they must be. They are indissolubly welded as coming from one idea.
Mm. What do these tablets tell us about the time after the Ark, like where the Ark is supposed to have landed? Because you point out in the book, the oldest map we have in the world tells where the Ark landed after the flood.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a surprising thing. So we've had this map since the 19th century, and it's really quite a famous map anyway. And what you get is you get ancient Mesopotamia drawn as a flat disk, and round it there's a cosmic sea in a ring, okay? Hmm. And then you have Mesopotamia in the middle with the cities and the rivers and so forth. But if you cross this cosmic ring in one of eight different directions, you come to these mountains, which were conceived to be on the rim of the world, presumably rising up into the sky. And there are eight of these mountains arranged more or less symmetrically round the rim of the circular world. Now, on this tablet in the British Museum, we have the map on one side, which is actually quite a good map. If you were flying over looking for it, it would be handy. But on the back, there is a description in Babylonian cuneiform of what's on each of these eight mountains. Now, unfortunately, I don't know what it was that jumped up and down on this tablet, but it's really badly damaged, and it's not possible to read everything. But it is possible to see that on one of the mountains, there is a quotation in the Babylonian from the story of the building of the Ark, which Douglas Simmons' tablet brought to light for the first time. Because in this Simmons tablet, when the boat is nearly ready, ribs have to be fitted inside the basketry to make it strong before it can be coated with bitumen. And the Noah character, this Atrahasis, he says to Engi, who wants reports on what's going on, "I cut these ribs," he says, "as thick as a barrel." And the word is not literally barrel in Babylonia, but it's the same kind of analogy that you express extreme thickness in volume, because a barrel is actually a volume measure. So they did in Babylonian. He said it's as thick as a parsec too. And this is a very strange thing to express thickness in volume terms. But on the map, on the description of one of the islands, it says if you cross this water in the direction of the mountain, when you get there, you will see, and then it's dot, 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 broken, something whose wood is as thick as a parsectu, as thick as a barrel. And this expression occurs nowhere else at all. So we can be sure that when describing what's on the mountain, he is talking about the ribs of the Ark. And that's where they thought the Ark came to rest in their story.
Irving Finkel. His book is called The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Irving Finkel, thank you very much for the time.
Big pleasure.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.